Well, some of us remember a time before we carried the entire information in the world in our pocket. Things have changed a lot over the years. There's a new book called The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. The author is Michael Harris and joins us. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, tell me a little bit about the overall premise of your book. Are we too connected today?
Sure. Well, the premise of the book is that my peers and I'm in my mid-30s, and my peers and I are part of this last generation that will ever live with memories from before the internet, that there is this fundamental Gutenberg-scale shift happening, and that the thing that those of us who lived before the internet are going to be the last people to remember is that quality of absence or solitude, the quality of not being able to connect with other people. So that's where The End of Absence takes its thrust from, I guess.
You write about that Gutenberg shift, and I read about that in your book, and I never really thought about that before, but in 1450, if I have my history right.
That's right.
The shift was, it changed the world as well in how people receive their information. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I mean, so in 1450, Gutenberg invents the printing press, or the modern one. There's some discussion about whether another printing press existed in China earlier, but we don't have to get into that, I guess. The printing press transforms communication. It allows Martin Luther to challenge the authority of the Catholic Church. It provides the mechanism by which the Enlightenment becomes possible by creating a single conversation among educated peoples in Europe. So it becomes the lens through which we see the world and through which we see ourselves. The difference between the printing press in the 15th century and the internet today is that the printing press took centuries before its effect was felt by the common man. It wasn't until the 19th century that literacy was common in England or Europe. So compare that, those hundreds of years of that slow-blooming Gutenberg era, to the internet today, where really in a single lifetime, monopolies of knowledge and the ways that we connect with each other have been radically transformed, and just so swiftly.
Well, I graduated from college before Wikipedia. I don't know how I did that. I'm wondering what it's like for today. Do we have too much information? I mean, it's great to be able to go to the internet when you have a question and get it answered. I do that all the time. But sometimes there's this flood of information, and it's hard to sift through it. Do we have too much at times today?
Well, this is a very good question. I wouldn't like to say that we have too much information. One thing we have too much of, I would argue, is too much opinion. I have a bias myself. I think that some opinions actually are better than others, and that if I'm going to be looking at contemporary art or new movies coming out, I would actually like to have a rarefied critical opinion rather than an aggregation of thousands of opinions, because to my mind, you can't actually aggregate taste. So that's one of the places where the internet seems to fall down for me. You mentioned Wikipedia. You know, Wikipedia makes mistakes. The Encyclopedia Britannica made mistakes also. But the difference between those two knowledge monopolies, you could call them, is that the Encyclopedia Britannica's mistakes were sort of honest mistakes, whereas in Wikipedia you find a kind of insidious push through corporations or religions or certain special interest groups where the truth online can become massaged. And so, you know, the democratic impulse of Wikipedia is a good one, but the number of editors at play can become a challenge in itself. I should also note that, you know, by Wikipedia's own standards, or sorry, own report, the editors are overwhelmingly male. I think it's around 95% male.
Hmm.
So when we see this mass of opinion and information flooding at us through something like Wikipedia, we still have to think about whose opinion, you know, what mass of people is this? It's not always going to be everybody. There are still these socioeconomic differences at play.
The whole idea of crowdsourced reviews, I know that I think it was the hotel industry that came under fire somewhat recently because they were spiking these reviews. I mean, how yeah. reliable are these reviews?
Well, that's an open question, really, and I don't think anyone has a definitive answer. We know that people, in the book I call it wagging the crowd, when you... you can actually hire a click farm in India to up your ratings on something. And we know that when somebody releases an album or a book, those star ratings on Amazon, they really matter. And people, you know, they encourage their friends to give them five stars on Goodreads or whatever. And there are also vindictive attacks on such sites. So while we know that these star ratings have a large effect on the actual commerce, the way it plays out, whether or not we can trust them is another matter.
We are speaking with Michael Harris, the author of The End of Absence. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with some of your questions and your comments. Stay with us. Thank you for joining the Jefferson Exchange today. I'm Milt Radford, filling in for Jeffrey Riley. We're talking about the new book, The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection, written by Michael Harris. How do you feel about that? Are you plugged in all the time? Do you have some suggestions or tips for how you can get unwired or un-unwired, whatever you want to call it? Give us a call at 1-800-838-3760 or give us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. And, of course, you can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Michael, I wanted to expand a little bit on what we were talking about before the break. Everyone is a reporter now across the world. You've had experience as a theater critic, correct?
That's right, yeah. I wrote theater reviews for a few years with the Globe and Mail here in Canada.
This whole notion that everyone is now a reporter, I suppose that's good news. We've seen some times where private individuals have broken stories that have gone nationwide. But then, as you say, everybody sort of weighs in, and there comes a time where the professional reporters need to take over or should.
Absolutely.
Is this kind of dangerous, this whole business of everyone thinking they're a reporter?
Well, citizen journalism has certainly shown positive and negative aspects. I mean, with the riots going on right now in your country, I think we see examples on Twitter and Facebook of ways that voices that might not be heard otherwise are given. A soapbox, given an opportunity to be heard, and in that way, something like Twitter creates a wonderful new However, citizen journalism, as it plays out on Twitter, is always about the immediate, right? And it can sometimes, I think, weigh the balance of attention toward very hasty judgments. And it doesn't leave much room at all for sober reflection. And certainly that's what we find in the larger media across the States and the world, that there's a movement toward reactive journalism and away from the kind of journalism that, for example, brought about Watergate, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask what all of this is doing to our attention span. When I speak to people of my generation, we sit down and we have some, I wouldn't say long, but longish by today's standards, conversations.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I speak to my own kids or folks, children in their generation, I almost feel like I have 140 characters that I have to get out what I have to say. Have we seen something bad happen to our attention spans?
There have been numerous studies on the way people read online. We do live in a text-gorged society. It's not that people are reading less. It's that our online technologies encourage us to read in a very ephemeral and disjointed way. And I think that's a sign of a shortened attention span. We tend to read only the first couple paragraphs of stories when we read online. And neuroplasticity research would suggest that living in that kind of attention, skittering kind of attention, living with that will create an expectation of constant distraction. So there is that danger, yes.
What is this doing to our memory? I think that would maybe be a separate thing, our shorter, our long-term memories.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, there's a chapter on memory in The End of Absence. And for me, the issue there is that we think of our computers as having memory, but we make a mistake when we offload our memories to our computers, because what they actually have is a recall system. A very, very effective, wonderful ability to recall exactly what you plugged in. But human memory is something very different. It's actually changing every time you remember something. You literally reform it in your mind, and you curate a kind of life story. We know from neuroscientists that every time you remember something, you change that memory a little bit. So the human memory that we mustn't give up on is so different from computer recall systems. And I think that's just an important distinction to make.
Your generation, you said you're part of the straddle generation, is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
So you had a fairly short period of time with relatively low tech, and then things started to change in a hurry. I'm thinking in my generation, I was in high school when a friend of mine bought an HP calculator, and he paid $400 for it, and he was like the coolest guy, coolest, nerdiest guy in school.
Right. So teachers at the time probably had a lot of problems with bringing a calculator to school.
Well, they were envious of his calculator, the math teachers were. But over time, you know, I was introduced to computers slowly through a Commodore 64 and some of these other ancient computers out there.
Right.
Your generation got hit with it pretty fast. Does that affect your age group in a different way than it did perhaps mine?
Well, I was born in 1980. And so I think of myself as kind of one of the last people through the gate, you know, to have those pre-internet memories. And certainly, I mean, everybody alive today, anybody younger than 70, has probably had their experience of things shaped by their use of online technologies. And as you go down the age brackets, it probably becomes a larger and larger component of your psyche. I'm 34 years old, so I feel like I began writing this book because I had this sort of lingering memory of what came before. And so the book was really a project to try and remember what was the value of solitude on a personal level and a larger cultural level.
In your book, you have some, we've talked about a couple of the terms that you have in your book, and some of these are funny. Some of them are a little more serious. One of the ones I want to ask you about is a flashcard confessional. Explain that.
Well, that came up because I was working on a chapter about Amanda Todd, who is a young girl in British Columbia who killed herself after years of online bullying. And before she killed herself, she created a video for YouTube, which became a kind of viral sensation. And it was just her silent, holding up these flashcards with text on them. And she would flip through these cards to confess the problems that she was going through. And it became a kind of suicide note, in a way. And when I looked into her story, I found there were actually many girls, a few boys, but mainly girls, who had done this. It had almost become a subgenre of autobiography. And I ended up calling it a flashcard confessional because it reminded me of the way people confess in church, actually. It was sort of this message going through a screen. When you go to a church, you have that message through a lattice work, but you know, online, it's through the screen of your laptop, and it's a message to this kind of faceless authority, where you're hoping for some kind of answer to come back.
When I first heard about these flashcard videos, I actually hadn't heard of her story yet. And my reaction was I immediately thought back to the old Bob Dylan song and the flashcards that he used in that. And I thought, well, this is like we have this new technology, but we're going retro back to an earlier time as well.
Yeah.
Paul is on the line from Grants Pass to talk about individual responsibility. Go ahead, Paul.
I think this is the piece that this entire conversation is missing, is that each of us has a responsibility to, like, we are not victims. We are not yet complete slaves of the machine. The system is working towards making us more dependent upon that. Yes, it's a tool. We've had tools all the way back to two stones. And the bottom line is that if the tool is used responsibly, it's great. If the tool is not used responsibly, then it can have disastrous results. The stone led to the atom bomb. Well, nuclear power can be used responsibly. Nuclear medicine, it's a good thing. On the other hand, information has always been with us, and information is a tool. This is simply a system of organizing and moving information in a much, much more efficient system, as your Gutenberg example came out. The bottom line is that each individual has a responsibility to use that tool responsibly and also to make sure they have a BS filter in there. It just flabbergasts me that people say, oh, I'm a victim of the Internet. No, you're not a victim of the Internet. You still have the ability to hit the off button. That's the end of my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Michael?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic comment because that's exactly what it comes down to. You know, I compare our media diets to our food diets. We evolved loving sugars and fats because they were rare. And now that we have a superabundance of sugar and fat, we have to be smart and we have to consume them. We have to use our own willpower to consume them in a healthy way. Similarly, we now have a superabundance of social connectivity. And the only way we're going to be healthy mentally is if we use our willpower to, as that caller said, use these tools when and how we want to, instead of having our tools use us.
Let me ask you about going Walden. What does that mean?
Sure. That was a term I came up with for my experience of taking a month off from the Internet. So in order to really see the way online life shaped me, I wanted to step away from it. In the same way that, you know, if you live in Portland and you want to really understand Portland, you need to travel away from Portland and then come back. You have to have that distance, I think. And so I wanted to give myself that distance from my online life. So I took 30 days offline, 30 days away from my cell phone, which was, you know, torture. But it felt a little bit in line with the way that Thoreau spent a couple years at Walden Pond, largely removed from society.
I read that as like a diary in your book, and it was it was simultaneously funny and a little painful because it was reflective of probably what all of us would feel. I was on a week-long bicycle trip once, and I think I had the shakes the first 3 days because we didn't have cell phone reception.
Yeah. I took a train across Canada about a year ago, and, you know, most of Canada is wilderness that has no Wi-Fi connection, and it was amazing seeing the train passengers alternately freak out or relax into that silence.
Well, tell me a little bit about your experiment that month that you went without being connected. What were some of the lessons you learned from it, either positive or negative?
Well, you know, I don't think that if you take a digital detox, you can expect some sort of brave epiphany at the end of it. What it teaches you is just how addicted to that connection you really were to begin with. Once that's been driven home for you, you get to start making more proactive decisions because you're more awake to the ways that your online addiction plays. It's such an insidious thing sometimes that it's hard to see. I would say for the first 2 weeks that I went offline, I almost, like you said, I almost had those jitters. I was dreaming of text messages. I remember that. At the same time, you know, by the third week, even though there was this kind of crushing loneliness about it, I became the best boyfriend in the world. Every time my boyfriend would come home, I'd be attentive to the, you know, nth degree, in a way that a digitally connected person, or digitally connected me anyway, wasn't able to do.
Did you become annoying to people around you because you were attentive and you weren't connected?
Yeah, I think it was more the other way. I think when I was out with people and they were checking their phone while they were talking to me, you know, after you spend a few weeks offline, that kind of behavior really starts to grate on you even more than it already does. So I tried to keep the holier-than-thou stuff down to a minimum.
Sometimes when my wife and I are on our phones together, either out at dinner or at home, one of us will look up and just say, parallel play, the old Piaget term, you know, for children who are in that particular stage of development.
Yeah.
And you have a term here, phone burrow, which kind of reminds me of that. Talk about that.
Phone burrow is a term that I came up with to describe this action I saw largely among adolescents, but also older people, in moments of anxiety or social uncertainty. The phone becomes almost like a soother, where you can duck into your phone or burrow into it to sort of hide yourself from the awkwardness of real life.
We are speaking this morning about the new book, The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. Michael Harris is the author. If you have any comments or questions that you've observed as a result of being constantly connected or seemingly so, give us a call here at the Jefferson Exchange. You can reach us at 800-838-3760, in the Medford-Ashland area, 541-552-6782, or you can email us jx@jeffnet.org. As a result of, Michael, of us losing our patience, it seems like, when we're disconnected from the Internet or something doesn't pop up as soon as we think it should,
Yeah.
Do you see that as a society thing? Are we becoming less attentive and, quicker to anger or rage as a result of expecting things to be there instantly?
Yeah, another one of those terms that you were referring to, there's a whole glossary of these terms at the back of the book, but another one of them was disconnection rage, which is, I think, what you're talking about. When we have this expectation of constant connection, we become extremely upset when it's torn from us. All happiness in the end is about expectation, I suppose. And I think that speaks to a larger fear of solitude that we have. We've become so poor at experiencing absence that whenever we run into a little quiet moment, we have that phone burrow. We dive into the phone. And it's a shame, because if you push through that little bit of discomfort, you enter into this mental space where you might discover things that you never knew you never knew.
We're talking with Michael Harris, author of The End of Absence. We'll be back with your phone calls and emails in a bit, right after this short break. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today. I'm Milt Radford, filling in for Jeffrey Riley. Today we're speaking with Michael Harris. He is the author of the book The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-838-3760 or send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. You can also check us out on Facebook or Twitter, unless you've already started your own digital detox, in which case you probably can. Let's go to the lines. We have Lauren with us in Phoenix, who says she's never had a cell phone. Go ahead, Lauren.
Hi there. It's very interesting to me. Not only have I never had a cell phone, I've never had a computer. I mean, of course, I use computers because there are things you can't look up otherwise. Sometimes it makes me insane that I have to go to a machine to find a phone number. But that's, not everybody advertises in phone books and on and on. But it's just interesting. I'm not trying to make any judgment here, but just my perspective of life right now is that I really liked life a lot better before technology. I don't think it's added a whole lot to my life. I can't stand how people have short attention spans. And I'm starting to get really, not rude, but I'm not patient with someone on the phone anymore when all I am doing, when I talk on the phone, it's a landline, and all I am doing is listening and talking to them. I'm usually sitting down. And sometimes I can tell they're checking their emails. So, I try to be polite about it, but I say, why don't I talk to you when you're not busy? Oh, I'm not busy. if someone is talking on the phone and driving, they're obviously not giving me the same kind of attention that I'm giving them.
Lauren, do you feel like you're ever missing out on anything? Because
never. Never. And when I ask people what they love about their cell phones, I mean, so many people tell me, well, they have one, but they hate it. So I don't feel ever like I'm missing out. And quite frankly, it's so easy to become addicted to the Internet. I've housed that where there is, full access to the computer. And I'd get online thinking I'm going to be on for 20 minutes and 4 hours would go by. And I would really be mad afterwards because I could have gone outside and walked around and looked at the sky. And that would have been, to me, a much better passage of time than staring into a screen.
Michael, let me ask you about that. What about that love-hate relationship that we have with technology?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what I'm hearing from that caller is there is a lot of frustration, obviously, but her experience is it's reminding me of the fact that we're going through this Gutenberg moment in such a quick way that there is that possibility that you can actually live outside of the technological reality of the majority of the world, really. I mean, she says she doesn't have a cell phone. The entire planet has a cell phone, roughly speaking. There are about 7 billion active cell phone accounts now, which means pretty much one phone for everybody. But some people have two phones, which is why Lauren can have zero, I guess. It's that the fact of pre-internet minds butting up against digital natives is such a rare and rich opportunity, I think, to try and transfer those values of solitude to the next generation.
You know, I heard a comedian one time say that the number one reason to have a smartphone is so that you don't go insane and violent when you're in the line at the DMV getting your license renewed. And so I think there's, you know, for some of us, certainly when you're stuck in line, it is nice to have a smartphone. But
it is. But every time we do that, right, there's this opportunity to start to look inward, and the gateway toward that rich interior life is actually that boredom that we're running away from, I think.
We have a call from Jeannie in Medford talking about television. Go ahead, Jeannie.
Oh, good. Before that, was her name Lauren, the previous caller, woman? That was the most beautiful way I could have ever stated it. But here's my statement. The first thing, if I have company and people come over, they say, oh, you have a lovely home. I swear, within 5 seconds, where's your TV? I say, I don't have one. And right away, it's like a family discussion. Honey, don't we have one in the garage we could give her? And do you need, we have these boxes at Walmart. And I said, you have short attention span. You didn't let me finish. I don't have one by choice.
Yeah, it's a different perspective, isn't it? Yeah,
and my guitar requires no batteries, and I have a xylophone, ear, and a stick. I'm good to go.
That's all you need in life. Well, you know, you think back as technology has changed, Michael. Of course, there was a time when maybe only one person on the street back in the 40s or the 50s had a television. Mm-hmm. And there was sort of like this reluctance, like radio was king back then because theater of the mind, and I don't need to have pictures spoon-fed to me. And hopefully some of our radio listeners still feel that way today. But
I hear stories from my mother about walking down the street to her friend's place because they had a color TV. So that's exactly what we're talking about, this history of communication technologies. It's not just about the internet. It's about a eons-long parade of transformations to the way that we communicate with each other. And when we talk to our elders about the ways that communication technology changed their lives, I think that's the best way for us to be intelligent about the way that we use our own technologies.
On the line now is Jacob in Springfield. Discuss connections, information connection. Go ahead, Jacob.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that internet connectivity and mobile technology, that's just a tool, just like a hammer. And you could use a hammer for good or for evil. You could use it to build a house, or you could use it to smash your neighbor who's sitting, you know, on the bus next door to you. But overall, I would consider it similar to electricity was about 100 years ago. But we have to differentiate the concept between information, knowledge, and wisdom. The internet and provides information, which is essentially a little bit more than processed data. You know, it tells you when the bus is coming, or it tells you, like, what the definition of a word is, or when this next rock group is coming to play in town for a concert. But the next step is actually knowledge, and that's actually applying that information into your life, into the present. And wisdom is actually going further. It's taking that and extrapolating it into the future and you know, giving advice and everything else. Knowledge and knowledge and wisdom, those are post-processing things that are done psychologically within your brain, okay? And just because you have the information doesn't mean you have the knowledge or the wisdom. You have to take some time to reflect on it and, you know, connect the dots and, you know, make cognitive, you know, judgments. And the computer can never decide for you, let's say, you know, which flavor of ice cream to have. It can tell you that chocolate has this many calories and vanilla has this many calories and strawberry has a pH of this. But it's your brain that you that ultimately decides and shapes your future.
How do you, Michael, let me ask you a question about that. How do you, with this sort of information overload, how do you wisely navigate through that to make these particular decisions that Jacob is talking about?
Right. Well, you know, I like that example he gave of these devices and technologies are just a tool. They're just a hammer. It's absolutely true. The danger comes when you're given nothing but hammers in your life, and then suddenly everything looks like a nail. You know, we forget that there are other tools in the toolkit. So when it comes to making decisions in your life, when we go online, we're constantly encountering a crowd, and it's an algorithmically defined decision-making machine. So if I go on Netflix, Netflix is going to be deciding what movies I should watch. Amazon is going to be giving me star rating for which books are the ones that I might like. And even Google is going to be showing me advertisements that it feels are up my alley because of something that it read in one of my emails. So it's only when we have time away from that also that we're able to develop that rich interior life where we can make independent decisions.
We all had a life before technology if we're of a certain age. Helga is in Ashland. Go ahead, Helga.
Okay. I am of a certain age. I'm 72 now. And when we came from Germany to America, my parents forbade us even to read comic books. We didn't have a television at all until I went to college. I really didn't see much television. And I'll tell you what effect it had on me. I found that on one level, it isolated me from my peers because they talked about things they saw on television that I couldn't relate to. On the other hand, I read a lot, and I mostly was observing. I was living life and using my eyes and paying attention and talking to people. You know,
well,
I had a personal life.
Well, Michael, talk a little bit about that, about balance.
Yeah, well, you know, when you look at the history of creative people, of artists and creative scientists, too, there always seems to be this thread of detachment or solitude somewhere, often in their childhood, where they'll be an immigrant, maybe, or their parents won't allow them television, or there'll be something that separates them so that they have to think for themselves, so that they have to assess the world in a unique or creative way. And I think maybe that's what that caller is getting at, that you can't arrive at bold new decisions by contributing to a comment feed at the bottom of a news story. You have to go into the world, but then also separate yourself from the world and go back and forth in order to really develop that rich interior life.
I read an article just a day or two ago about somebody who was conducting an experiment where they stopped liking things on Facebook because they were so overwhelmed by the advertising and the type of stories that were being pushed at them. And it really, it took a couple of weeks, but it really had a profound effect on changing their Facebook feed into something that they felt was more tolerable, more positive for them.
There's an amazing book called The Filter Bubble that talks about how Facebook and Google shapes your feed and what you see, not just advertisements, but the feed on your Facebook wall based on what it thinks that you're going to want to click on.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Let me ask you this question, Michael. This is probably for a younger generation, maybe my own kids, like folks who've been plugged in their whole life.
Yeah.
Let's say that I'm going to try to sell them on the advantage of boredom. What would you say to them? What would you tell them to convince them to, not to give up technology altogether, but to be connected a little bit less and to just spend some time with their own thoughts?
I would tell them that it's not about depriving them of anything. It's about giving them a larger world that, I don't want digital natives to experience abstinence, some kind of complete separation from that connectivity. It's that I want them to have both. I want everybody to have rich lives online and rich lives offline. So that ultimately there's a kind of hedonism about it, that you should be able to experience a larger world.
So all of the recommendations that we get at times from book clubs, from Amazon, from Netflix and such, they're not necessarily the last word. We need to learn to trust our own judgment.
Yeah. There's that experience of flipping through a bookstore and finding things by accident, too.
Well, we have been talking today with Michael Harris, the author of The End of Absence. He has joined us again. His book, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection, highly recommended. Some suggestions in the book, and the terminology in the back is also quite funny. Some of the terms that you've come up with to describe our addictions and how we interact with technology and the things that we do with that. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange, we'll get some details on the upcoming Festival of Eugene. Then the wolverine removed from the proposed endangered species list. And at 9 o'clock, we'll get an Italian cooking lesson from the author of a beautiful new book called The Glorious Vegetables of Italy. You can join us here tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. The producer at the Exchange is Charlotte Duran. I'm Milt Radford, filling in today for Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for joining us, and everyone, have a great day.